I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Before we get to our agenda, I'll go through a few items. Everyone here today, please be seated when you're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need further accommodation, please reach out to the sergeant staff. Signs aren't permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. Additionally, all of the testifiers who've signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to these time limits or we may have to cut you off, and we don't like to do that. Similarly, members of the public who choose to testify will be provided with a time limit as well. Thank you to our sergeant's office staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee hearing room. And we have 7 bills on the agenda today. And thank you to everybody who submitted letters and written testimony. Those are also posted online for the public. The first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Ream, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 19, 2025?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Yes, I move to approve the minutes from March 19, 2025.
Representative Ream moves approval of the minutes for March 19, 2025. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. The first bill on the calendar for today is House File 1265. It's Representative Keeler's bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Keeler. I will move to recommend that House File 1265 be placed on the general register. I see that you don't have any amendments, so when you're ready, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 1265 is a bill in front of you that just seeks to update and improve the American Indian cultural programming requirements within the Department of Corrections. As we know, Native Americans make up approximately 1% of Minnesota's population, yet they represent over 9% of the state's incarceration population, particularly troublesome 25% of the female incarceration population. What these changes do, which my testifiers we'll talk more about, is just updating wording that is far outdated that will provide the better supports that we need for cultural representation. And with that, we'll move over to Wendy Spray.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1265. My name is Wendy Spray, and I am the Tribal Relations Director for the Department of Corrections. I'm a member of the White Earth Nation, and I also act in the role of tribal liaison for our agency. So for a little background about how we came here today, during just the routine policy review process, I was handed the policy on American Indian cultural programming. And as I read through it, I found some of the language a little questionable, outdated, and so I started talking with people and bringing it forward. And learned that, you know, our policy reflected the actual statutory language, which was written in 1985, which was groundbreaking and wonderful, and we're so happy to have it, but it was time for a change. And a little more research, I learned that I think we changed American Indian counseling programs to American Indian cultural programs. So one word was changed in those 40 years. So we thought it was something we probably needed to bring up to date. So the proposal was brought to the various tribal nations with whom we engaged in consultation over the last year or so. They also shared our significant concerns with the statutory language and really its ability to truly serve the needs of incarcerated American Indians. The statute as it stands contains terminology that is harmful and perpetuates outdated stereotypes. Our proposal aims to replace this language that better reflects our shared values, respect, and partnership with tribal nations. Research does show that culturally relevant programs help reduce recidivism rates. Incarcerated Native Americans who engage in culturally specific and relevant programming have lower recidivism rates compared to those who do not participate. And we've been able to develop some of those cultural programs in our facilities and continue to improve in that area and add opportunity. These programs improve mental health, strengthen cultural connections, and contribute to overall well-being, all factors that are essential for rehabilitation and successful reentry into our communities. By revising Statute 241.80, we're creating a pathway for improved rehabilitation for incarcerated Native Americans. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for your leadership on this important issue, and thank you, Chair and Committee members, for allowing me to speak today in support of this bill, and I stand for any questions you may have. Miigwech.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Fred Darjarle. Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, that's right on.
All right, great. Welcome to the committee. Please reintroduce yourself for the record and then begin your testimony.
So for Lightning Man's my name, and Anishinaabe Moen. I'm from Red Lake. I live in South Minneapolis. I'm a cultural coordinator for our tribe, and I'm also a volunteer for Minnesota DOC. And it's an honor to come speak a little bit, and I wanted to share some of the highlights of the work that I do that directly affects some of the relatives incarcerated and some of the bill, this language that it'll affect directly. So over the course of the past 6 years or so, I've been volunteering as a state cultural coordinator on my own time. And some of the things we do is bridge the gap for cultural, and that could mean anything. Cultural is just as simple as sitting here listening in a room. But when we're able to have access to language, sweat lodge, drum, all of these things that through our lens to bring that accessible in a setting where it's so beneficial in a time of need, I think in that moment, being able to bridge that and bring that resource to our relatives, it picks them up, and I think that's some of the disconnect that may have led our relatives in there. So when we change the statute to some wording that makes sense in today's times, that'll provide equitable access to our relatives and give them a little bit more hope in that time of struggle, time of need. And that's why I'm here today, is to share that, because every time I go into a facility, I see little lights light up in every individual. And I've been into the female prisons, I've been into the male prisons, and I'm able to bridge that gap. And something like this is really going to be beneficial across the board, because right now, every time I go in there, it's the same story. We don't have equitable access, and it all comes down to policy, and that's why we're here. And it's really good to share a little bit. But again, I know how important it is from my own story, and I was there. Mm-hmm. And having that access to that culture, to them elders and resources that came in, goes a long way. And I also connect with the relatives inside and when they get out on reentry. So it's something that's needed, something that's so beneficial, and I believe in it, and I believe in all of our relatives. So I thank you for your time today. I wanted to speed up, and I was going to do most of it in the language, but I wanted to get right to the point. So thank you for your time. Miigwech.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks to you both for the important work that you do. We did not have anybody sign up in advance to testify from the public, but is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Rapinski.
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing this forward. I appreciate it. How many people take advantage of this, or what kind of need do you see currently? Do you have any kind of idea or numbers?
Mr. Darjarle.
Oh, yeah, thank you. So I go into Stillwater. Stillwater, just recently, they start letting out all units. And all units, there's probably 60-some natives that come out, relatives that have access to this. We can't all fit in a sweat lodge at once, but we're able to do teach-ins. Same thing in Rush City. We get a high number of relatives there. Over 60-plus come out at once. So the main thing I see is we don't have access to wood and rocks for sweats. And that's a barrier, because us as natives, it's a little different than other, Muslims and Christians, so forth. You know, this is who we are. So we're always trying to forever bridge that gap, and it all comes down to something like this, to where they can go back to and reflect what says this in policy. How do we make that go out there? So the numbers are high in every facility I go to. Faribault's the same. I think there's even more there that come out. And then even in the female facility, there's we built a sweat lodge there last year. It was a high number, and it surprised me. But, you know, I know that having access to this goes a long way. So that's just a brief, if hopefully I answered that. Good.
Representative Rapinski, anything else?
One more, Chair. Thank you.
Yep,
thank you for testing. And I'm in support of this. How is there any kind of cost to it that you looked at? Is there a fiscal note or any kind of?
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Because it's only language changes, we're not actually investing in any materials at this time. It's cost neutral.
Any other member questions? Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Keeler, and to your testifiers for taking the time today to address this important issue. And I think, too, just a lot of the conversations we have in public safety when it comes to corrections is we're trying to keep people connected to the things that are positive in their life. And, you know, it's so, so true that for people in indigenous communities, being disconnected is historically something that has happened. Whether or not people are in the criminal justice system, this has just happened to everyday people who are Native. And so I think when we can make our language more reflective of what we're trying to do and keep people connected to those deep cultural roots that push people in a positive direction to hang on to that connection, it's important for all of us, but it's particularly crucial for the indigenous community. So I appreciate the attention to this. And thank you, Chair, for hearing the bill.
All right. Representative Keeler, closing comments.
Thank you for the consideration, Wopidaw, for your time, and also just making sure that overall we would love to reduce the percentage of individuals that are in incarceration, but as we continue to work on that as a greater effort, making sure that we have the appropriate services, I think, is key. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll renew the motion to recommend that House File 1265 be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, thanks again. Next, we have House File 264, Representative Hansen. And I will move to recommend that House File 264 be placed on the general register. I also don't see any amendments to your bill. And so welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen. And whenever you're ready, go ahead with your explanation of the bill, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, for taking the time to hear about this important issue, and for the members on the committee that spoke with me about this ahead of time. I appreciate your time as well. House File 264 seeks to make sure that people who go to jail are provided with the same medications they were on before they went to jail, unless they choose otherwise or unless there is a new regimen recommended by another healthcare professional while they are there. It also encourages jails to verify Jarvis orders as they can, though I do want to recognize that I am aware it is difficult to do so, given that that is a county system, and referencing this from county to county can be difficult. But I have had conversations with sheriffs and a couple sheriffs and different jail administrators who says there is a way to make sure that that can be checked as well, and we can improve that and use those tools. I'm also aware that officers and jails generally do their best to collect a person's medications upon arrest, and sometimes it's just not possible to do so. And lastly, I also want to make sure that you know I'm aware that most anything related to medications requires nurses or other medical professionals to coordinate with the person's providers and pharmacy to confirm those medications and the dosage. And I know that this specialized staff is not always available, especially on weekends, and I assure you that if the funds were available, I would have included an appropriation for that in my bill as well, so I want to recognize that. Members, when someone goes to jail, the expectation is that they lose their freedom for a period of time, of course, but certainly not their health nor their lives. When someone does not have access to the critical medications prescribed to them by their doctor, this can create dangerous situations for everyone involved, themselves included. Corrections officers, other inmates, social workers, nurses, and everyone else can be put at risk in unnecessary situations when people are not given the proper medication that they need for their health condition. We know that access to mental health medications can help keep people stable in what is a very stressful situation. And suddenly stopping some of these medications can result in suicidal ideation or attempts, rapid onset symptoms that were not present at intake, catatonia, seizures, heart attacks, or more. These effects can happen when they are in jail or after release. Families of people on mental health medications often report the challenges that they face with their loved ones as they try to help them reestablish consistent medicating following release. This roller coaster to reestablish stability creates an additional barrier to those helping people leaving jail, like probation officers, courts, social workers, therapists, psychiatrists, and more, who are trying to do their part to reduce recidivism and to support someone who is both justice involved and unnecessary medication. People who need life-saving medications and sustaining medications like insulin, anti-seizures, HIV drugs, and heart medications can result in unpredictable and near immediate crisis if these meds are not made available to them. And responding to the effects of withdrawal or other medical emergencies in jail require corrections officers and medical staff to address these emergent situations as opposed to monitoring the rest of the operations. This bill was brought forward by Christine Hill, who lost her son, Larry Hill. And I want to turn it over to her so you can hear her story and more about the work she's done to get this before you today. Thank you, Chair.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Christine Hill. I'm the mother of Larry Ramon Hill. He died in Hennepin County Jail in 2023. At the time of 2023-22, inmates had died in Minnesota County jails. I'm here today to speak in Larry's name. I'm sorry.
It's okay, take your time.
There has been many people denied the prescription medication while incarcerated in county jails. When people in jail don't get their medication, they go through withdrawals. They can lead into serious emergencies that happened to my son. My son didn't eat for 15 days or drink. And from down there, he died. If he would have had his medication, he would have been here today. I used to work at corrections. I understand how it is for people not to have their medication. It's difficult. It's stressful. But when a person is on their medication, it's more manageable for everybody in the correction facility. Everybody can be safe. Not just the inmates, but the workers, the social workers, attorneys that can offer help will be able to do the job more better. I'm not asking for a lot. I just wish that you guys will pass the bill. And I would like to save other people's and other families from going through what I am going through. I want to say thank you guys for listening to me today. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Thank you so much for your testimony, and on behalf of the committee, our apologies for your loss and our gratitude for you being here and advocating so that this doesn't happen to other people like it happened to your son. It really means a lot to us that you're here today. So thank you. Next, Danielle Mathias,
yes,
please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Mueller and committee members. My name is Danielle Mathias. And for the past 18 months, I've been court watching hundreds of hours. So I'm here today to ask you respectfully to support House File 264, the Larry R. Hill Medical Reform Act. A lack of medical care in our county jails is not just a crisis, it's a violation of basic human rights. Through our court watching program, I've witnessed time and time again people in custody being denied essential medical care. And this isn't just theoretical. Just yesterday, in a Ramsey County courtroom, I sat with 9 other observers who heard a public defender plead with the judge to release his client because she hadn't received her critical psychiatric medication while in custody. These moments aren't rare, and they're happening every single day in our courtrooms across Minnesota. And we've been there to witness and document it. Our court watchers have shared heartbreaking reflections, like, quote, "The lack of access to health care for people in custody is shameful," said a St. Thomas law student. Or, quote, "There were clear medical and mental health concerns. One man hadn't received his medication for schizophrenia and was visibly unwell," said Elspeth. And the last quote I'll share is, quote, Arguments were made seem to have to do with mental and physical health concerns and stressing the importance for folks to be released for those reasons, Kate shared. And these aren't isolated incidences. These are symptoms of a system that treats medical neglect as acceptable collateral damage. No one should be forced to suffer preventable harm simply because they're incarcerated. Denying essential medication is not neglect, it's a form of abuse. People shouldn't have to start from scratch with their health care simply because they've been detained. Ensuring that individuals receive the same medication they were prescribed before entering custody is critical. The disruption of a medication regimen, especially for someone who has chronic or mental health conditions, can lead to serious medical crisis, destabilization, and long-term harms. This doesn't just impact that person, it impacts their families, court outcomes, and the overall safety and functionality of our correctional facilities. This is why I'm asking you to support the Larry R. Hill Act, Medical Reform Act, because this bill would require correctional facilities to provide essential medications without interruption, ensure compliance with court-ordered prescriptions and treatments, and set clear, enforceable standards to protect the health and dignity of people in custody. It would also prevent medical emergencies that endanger people incarcerated and the jail staff. We know these changes are needed because Christine Hill has lived the unimaginable consequences of a system that failed to act. We've seen firsthand how the lack of care escalates into emergencies, and this bill offers a path towards prevention, dignity, and accountability. So I ask for you to support House File 264.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We did not have anyone else sign up to testify, but are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any, so we will move on to member discussion. All right, Chair Novotny.
I just have a couple of questions. First of all, Madam Chair, for Representative Hansen, and just to get it out, I know it was one of the questions and we addressed it beforehand, but one of the concerns we had is does it have to be specific medications or can it be at the generic?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Novotny. At this point, that's up to the nurse on staff. If the nurse on staff finds that a generic is available and that would be more affordable and that's what the patient is okay with as well, that's fine with us. We just want to make sure that the medicines are getting there. We do know that there are some medications that don't offer a generic yet, and so obviously in that case it wouldn't apply, but we want to make sure folks are at least getting the chemical compound, whatever it's branded as, would be great.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Next question I have is for the nonpartisan staff. Getting into the scope of the bill, does this cover all correctional facilities? So is it state-run? There's some confusion on thing. The bill summary states that the bill requires all correctional facilities in the state. And I believe other parts it says licensed facilities would lead it to believe it was just county-run facilities. So is it state-run or all facilities?
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, the DOC takes the position that the statute this bill is amending, only applies to jails and local facilities. The definition within that statute refers to correctional facilities broadly, but I've been told they've successfully defended the scope of that statute because it refers to licensed facilities, and their DOC facilities are not licensed. But I understand they're also looking for legislation to clarify the statute to make it, but it's their position that it does not apply to their state-run facilities.
Chair Novotny.
Excuse me. So we're at that it's just for licensed facilities, so it just applies to counties.
That's Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, Representative not me. Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Anything further? Any other member discussions? All right. Would you like to make closing comments, Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for taking time to hear this bill, and thank you for joining us today. We've all heard stories about folks that we've lost. I, too, have lost folks that should have been on medications, and I know that this is a pain that stays with you forever. But we also know that storytelling changes the world and can help us save more people. So I thank you for your time today, for welcoming Christine, and for your kind words, Chair. And I hope you'll include this in your bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you again for our testifiers and also to everybody who submitted letters. There's quite a large packet that we have of letters of support. And with that, I'll renew the motion to recommend that House File 264 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Next, we have Representative Norris. Are you in the room? There you are. All right. House File 2354. I will move to re-refer House File 2354 to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. Members, the testimony and discussion to this bill will focus on Section 3 related to criminal penalties. And I do see that you have an author's amendment, the A2. So I will move the A2 amendment. Representative Norris, is there anything you'd like to say about the A2 amendment?
Chair Mueller, is it possible to have Mr. Johnson do a brief walkthrough of the A2 amendment for us?
Sure. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to look at the A2 amendment. This is replacing Section 3 in the bill. It is the same general concept, but there are a few substantive changes and a few technical changes. I'm going to walk through quickly, sort of subdivision by subdivision. Subdivision 1 establishes the offense. The change in the amendment affects the mental state. This requires a person to intentionally submit a claim or something similar for reimbursement through Medicaid, and to know that the information being submitted is false, or to reasonably should have known that that information was false. The penalties are the same structure from the original bill, but clarified to indicate that the state is not required to provide reimbursement before these penalties kick in. Under the current theft statute, sometimes someone has to receive something of value for it to be a completed theft. Otherwise, it's treated as an attempt. This would make it so that the penalties upon submission would apply. It would not require the payment. There are some technical changes to the aggregation language to make it line up with a few other existing statutes that simplifies it. And that, I think, is the extent of the changes and the amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. And Representative Norris, your bill as amended is before us. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. Minnesotans are a generous people. When our neighbors and our communities are struggling, we believe in offering them a helping hand. That's why it's disappointing, frustrating, and quite frankly, completely unacceptable when that generosity is taken advantage of. Medical assistance fraud steals from hardworking taxpayers across Minnesota. It also steals from money meant to provide health care to our low-income neighbors. That's disgraceful, and we need to cut down on this kind of fraud. Attorney General Ellison's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit already does great work catching people who steal from medical assistance and making sure they're held accountable. In fact, an audit recently found that compared to similarly sized states, our state has won the most convictions for provider fraud. And this unit, with a budget of about $5 million per year, has won over $53 million in civil penalties and criminal restitution over the last 5 years. Today, in this committee, we're focusing on specifically Section 3. Mr. Johnson did a great job of walking through those provisions, and it's designed to help give the Attorney General's office the tools that they need to aggressively investigate and prosecute Medicaid fraud. And with that, Chair Mueller, I actually have a representative from the Attorney General's office here to provide additional information.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
I'm Nick Wonka, the Director of Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is housed in the Attorney General's office, and today I'm here to testify in support of House File 34, otherwise known as the MAP Act. Now, I lead a team in the Attorney General's office of 32 investigators and prosecutors who dedicate 100% of their time to the investigation and prosecution of Medicaid provider fraud and the abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults who reside in certain settings. And today I'm going to be focusing my testimony on the sentencing provisions in the bill. These sentencing provisions are already in place elsewhere in Minnesota law, in Minnesota Statute 60952, Subdivision 3. They're the same penalties, for other theft crimes, and this bill uses identical language to those penalties that have already been in place for years. With the MAP Act, we are seeking to align penalties for offenders who steal taxpayer dollars from the Medicaid program with those offenders who steal from any other source. We aren't asking for more severe penalties or less severe penalties, just that someone who steals Medicaid money is treated the same as someone who steals from anyone else. Those who seek to defraud the program should know the consequences for stealing money that should be going to providing critical health care services to Minnesota's most vulnerable populations are the same as if they steal from any other source. And the penalty provisions sought here will ensure that's the case. We also support all of the other amendments that have been noted to the bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe, Mr. Keller, you're just here for questions, right? Okay. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? I am not seeing any, so we can move on to member discussion. Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. For someone from the county attorney's office, or state attorney general's office, you said you have 32 active investigators or attorneys in the attorney general's office right now. This bill, I believe, adds one.
Mr. Wonka.
Go ahead.
It adds nine. It brings us to 41 people. That is based on a recommendation from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General for our staff unit size.
Chair Novotny.
Let's see the numbers working out for that. How many employees will we be adding?
It would be a total of 41 people. Right now we have 32, so it would add nine.
It's in this.
Okay. So, Madam Chair.
Oh, Chair Novotny.
So my question would be is, what are the employees that we have already at the Attorney General's office that appear to be specifically assigned to do this Medicare? What have they been doing if this is a problem that it's gone so awry?
Mr. Wonka.
So this money that we're asking for, we're only asking for a 25% state match. Our federal funding, the federal grant in the federal government will pay for 75% of the costs of these nine employees, but we are required to get the remaining 25% from the state.
Chair Novotny.
Madam Chair. It goes back to my original question. How many prosecutions have come out of that unit in the last year?
Mr. Wonka.
Yep. Last year, we charged 58 provider fraud cases. That was fifth in the nation. The other four Medicaid fraud units had substantially bigger budgets, unit sizes. They were Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Arizona.
Chair Novotny.
I'm sensing a trend here, but thank you. That'll be it.
Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris, for bringing this bill. And every Monday morning at 8:15, we, those of us who are on the Fraud Prevention and Government Oversight Committee, talk about this. And we have actually had a lot of your, over the last couple of years, the cases that you have brought, the press releases cited from both sides of the aisle in terms of the good work and the important work that our state is doing on this issue. So I really appreciate the work. And I think, as you described, punching above our weight. I have a quick question as we're thinking about a biennial budget and the work, and you talked about we're already under, and there's a 75-25% match. What happens if that, one, is there any concern about the budget from the federal government, that match changing? And if so, what kind of hole will that leave in our efforts to fight Medicaid provider fraud?
Representative Norris.
Chair Mueller, Representative Greenman, I can address that briefly, and then I'll maybe turn it over to Division Manager Wonka for a little bit additional color on that. You know, one of the great things about this is that there is, in theory, this 3-to-1 federal match that's allowing our state dollars to go even further. You know, I know we're all worried about cuts at the federal level right now. I know Medicaid is in the crosshairs. Quite frankly, I think it would be irresponsible to cut funding to states to fight Medicaid fraud. So my hope and expectation would be that the federal government does not cut this. But, you know, I guess I've been surprised before in the last couple of months. But maybe I'll turn it over to Division Manager Wonka to talk a little bit further about that.
Mr. Wonka.
We have not received any indication from anybody at the federal government that this funding is in jeopardy. As recently as yesterday, I was in communication with our grants manager about the progress of this bill and our request for 41 people for the next federal fiscal year. And she had indicated that we are on track for that and that there is no concern about us not being approved for that if the state match is in place.
Representative Greenman, anything else?
Thank you. Just another question about and more about the way that this works and how we can help with this bill and other bills potentially support this. So when we're talking about this Medicaid, for the most part, we're talking about state and federal money together. And the resources, the 25% match actually sounds like a good deal for us. Are there things that are specific to Medicaid provider fraud that we see in Minnesota that that we should be thinking about as it relates to the prosecution and the kinds of tools you need to continue to do this work and punch above our weight and hopefully do more?
Mr. Wonka.
I think this act contains pretty much what we're asking for right now, which is more people to continue to investigate and prosecute these crimes. There's some additional tools in this bill, including increased subpoena power to obtain certain records that will help streamline our investigations as well. The overall package is a very good bill.
All right, Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris. I'm definitely in support of the crux of this bill, but I want to address something that one of your testifiers said, that 58 were charged.
Yes.
Last year, how many convictions were there?
Mr. Wonka.
Are you talking about of those 58 charged? I don't have those numbers because many of them are still moving through the system. There were 36 convictions last year, but many of those predated the 58 that were charged. It's not a straight 36 out of 58. Comparison, the 36 convictions were ninth in the country, for what that's worth.
Representative Ingen.
That is all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Following up on that, I don't want to add work for you, but it sounds like those are absolute numbers, and so maybe if you could follow up with us on, like, per capita in terms of whether it's per number of staff or the size of the budget, because I suspect that when you reference Ohio and Texas, that those fifth in the nation and ninth in the nation figures might actually go up. We might be even higher. So just would be interested. I doubt that you'd have that at your fingertips, but I'd be interested in some follow-up on that. And then the other thing I'll maybe just note just as something to think about, I'm noticing that that the crime, I'm looking at the amendment, that any intentional presentation of a claim for payment, et cetera, of any size at all would be at base a level four felony with the equivalent of theft above $1,000, et cetera. That may well be appropriate given the nature of this crime, but I do, just when I think about fitting this in with other crimes, it is notable to me that there's sort of no de minimis amount, or if it's a, $100 claim, that's still a felony. Obviously very, very concerning, but when I compare it to other crimes, I just would want to think as we continue this to make sure that we're setting the penalty levels up to calibrate them against other crimes that are out there. This is obviously something to go after. I appreciate the AG's office work on this. And Representative Norris, thanks for your leadership as well. Thanks, Chair.
Any other member discussion? Closing comments, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Appreciate the good conversation we've had with the committee today. I think this bill puts some additional tools in our toolbox at the state level with hopefully some help from the federal government to continue to make sure that those resources, those public dollars that are meant to help low-income Minnesotans get the health care and services they need actually go there. And I want to thank the Attorney General's office for their work that they've done so far on this important issue.
Thank you. Thanks for being here today as well to testify. I renew the motion to recommend that House File 2354, as amended, be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, we're going to switch the gavel here. Okay, the next bill on today's agenda is House File 1083, Chair Mohler's bill. Chair Mohler, would you like to move to recommend that House File 1083 be placed on the general register?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my motion.
Great. Your bill is before us, and we do have an A2 amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like?
I will, and I'll just say with the A2 amendment that this is something that we have been working on since the bill had it stop in judiciary, wanted to make it really clear, really with the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, who will be here to testify, to address some of the concerns they have. So I don't really like using this terminology. There's peace in the valley now with this amendment. So that is my amendment. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So Chair Mueller moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, oh, nope, we've done the amendment. Okay, so your bill is before us. Please tell us about your bill as amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So there are statutes that have privileges for certain communications that we really want to encourage people to have those communications and know that those remain confidential. The one we probably hear about the most is attorney-client privilege. Everybody understands what that means. We want people to be able to talk to their attorneys and give them the information to get the best representation. The statute contains a number of other privileges like medical, doctor and patient, mental health provider, patient. There's one for sexual assault advocates and victims. And there is one in statute for domestic violence advocates and victims. But for whatever reason, when that was enacted, there was a carve out that provided that courts could order access in those situations, which really does have a chilling impact on when victim survivors are talking to their advocates. It really makes no sense why it would be different for sexual assault advocates and victims. And one of the things that is particularly challenging, there are advocates who are trained as both sexual assault advocates and domestic violence advocates. And so you could have a victim coming to you who's experienced both types of crimes. You'd be like, well, for purposes of the sexual assault crime, our conversation is privileged, but for purposes of the domestic violence crime, it may not be, the court may order it. Really confusing for both advocates and for victim survivors. And so this bill seeks to make this privilege be the same as the other privileges in statute. And I do have a testifier here.
Great. Thank you so much. And so the first testifier we have listed is Rana Alexander. If you'd like to introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Raina Alexander, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 1083. Domestic violence is an underreported crime. Among the many reasons that victims give for not reporting or seeking help is the loss of anonymity and privacy that comes with engaging in the criminal justice system. Access to confidential advocacy services, crisis support, and ongoing counseling is critical to the health, recovery, and safety of domestic violence victims. Working with a community-based domestic violence advocate can provide a safe, confidential, and non-judgmental opportunity for a victim of domestic violence to consider all available options while addressing any pressing needs, including crisis support and access to services, and responding to the trauma that they have experienced. In 2008, the Minnesota legislature, without a single no vote or any objection, recognized that the public interest in a domestic violence victim's health and safety rises to the level of justifying the creation of a specific privilege protecting that confidential information. We are now asking the legislature to update the statute to bring it in line with the sexual assault counselor privilege. In 2022, the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a decision saying that the sexual assault counselor privilege is an absolute privilege. However, the court also found that the domestic abuse advocate privilege was to have broad exceptions, including that the court could order disclosure of an advocate's records and conversations. This means that if a domestic violence victim seeks support from a domestic abuse advocate, their conversations are not strictly privileged. Considering between 40 to 45% of domestic violence victims will also be sexually assaulted at some point in their relationship, if the same domestic violence victim is speaking to a sexual assault advocate, that conversation is strictly privileged. However, many programs serve both domestic and sexual violence victims, which means a victim could tell their story to one advocate and part of their story about sexual violence would be absolutely privileged, and the other part of their story about domestic violence would not be. This leaves victims and domestic violence advocates unclear about whether their conversations are absolutely privileged. Domestic violence victims deserve to have the same protected conversations with their domestic abuse advocate as they could have with a sexual assault counselor. Thank you, and I'm happy to take your questions now.
Okay. Thank you so much. And to our next testifier, just so you know, we're on a tight schedule, so we have 2 minutes. And if you'd like to introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Jill Brisvoit, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in support of House File 1083 with the A2 Amendment. We acknowledge the bill's recognition of the vital role domestic abuse advocates play in supporting victims, but we also believe it is essential to ensure that the statute aligns with longstanding constitutional and ethical obligations, particularly the prosecution's duty to disclose material information to the defense. The A2 amendment is critical because it clarifies that nothing in this bill alters that duty. Under Brady versus Maryland and Rule 9 of the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedures, prosecutors must turn over any information favorable or unfavorable in the possession of those who participate in the investigation or prosecution of a matter, including victim advocates working with law enforcement or prosecution. It is important to distinguish domestic abuse advocates from sexual assault counselors. While sexual assault counselors provide confidential counseling with limited involvement in the justice system, domestic abuse advocates often serve as liaisons sharing victim preferences about case outcomes, no contact orders or programming with prosecutors or law enforcement. When the information informs the prosecution's work, it must be treated as discoverable. This clarification in A2 not only protects due process, but it promotes the timely and fair resolution of cases. When victims share their views with advocates, that information can help resolve cases efficiently and in ways that honor the victim's voice. If such information is withheld, it risks undermining the integrity of the process and can even lead to unavoidable mistrials, because there are times that undisclosed information provided by victims through an advocate is not passed on to defense attorneys. The amendment ensures that all relevant information reaches both sides, safeguarding fairness, transparency, and justice. We respectfully urge you to support the House File 1083 with the A2 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much. And now we will move to member discussion. And I'll just lead things off to say just congratulations and thank you for just tirelessly working to make sure that everybody could come together and address all the concerns and move forward with this really important bill. So thank you. Any other members? Yep, Representative Steer.
I just have a question for House Research. I just want to clarify that, and I think I covered this in judicial, but the 626557 on line 4.17 does not interfere with any kind of mandatory reporting requirements.
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Steer. The 626557 is the mandatory reporting related to vulnerable adults, and the Chapter 260E is the mandatory reporting related to children. And what this does, both in current law and is retained in the bill, is it basically creates an exception. And the exception says that nothing in this paragraph exempts people who are mandatory reporters from reporting under those provisions.
Representative Steer, no problem. Any other comments? Lead Novotny?
Vice Chair, Chair Mueller, thank you for bringing this forward. It's a question of what's the most important thing, and in the hierarchy of need of these victims in the domestic abuse is getting that first step. And you can't do anything else until you get that first step, and they have to be confident that if they reach out that they can do that and have confidence in the person that they're going to speak with. And you've got to, you got to set that hook, and you've got to get them if you're going to bring them aboard. So this is a good bill. I like the amendment. The amendment really cleans it up and makes things clear so that anybody that has any objections to this, I don't know why they would, but this should clear everything up, and I recommend agreement.
Thank you.
into.
Any closing comments? Just quickly, thank you to Ms. Alexander for all her work on this issue for literally over a decade now. and also thanks to MacDill for your engagement and willingness to talk through your concerns. Really excited that we got to this point and appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. So Chair Mueller renews her motion to recommend that House File 1083, as amended, be placed on the general register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. All right, next on the calendar, we have House File 1659. This is Representative Curran's bill. Would you like to move that House File 1659 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
First, I think, Chair, we have, are we doing the amendment first?
Yeah, but we just say yes to the motion.
Okay.
That is your motion.
Yes, Chair, that is my motion. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. And now we're going to wait to take up the A1 okay. until after we take testimony on the bill.
Got it.
So go ahead and tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. Today in your packets, you have a really awesome handout that shows the highlights of the DOC technical omnibus bill that we're looking at today. I think it clearly lays out what the Department of Corrections is looking for in the bill. So to move us along, I'll just turn it right over to our testifier.
All right, and I see that we have Deputy Commissioner Khan here, so please introduce yourself and begin.
Chair Mueller and members of the committee, my name is Safia Khan and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. I want to first thank Representative Curran for bringing this legislation forward on our behalf. I'm here to provide you a closer look at the provisions within House File 1659 and explain how they will support the work of our agency. As Representative Curran mentioned, you have in your packets this really lovely handout that was created by Kelly Half, our legislative director, and it details the big four changes that are in this bill. The first change is affixed to the protective agent exemption that the legislature created for the DOC and sheriffs last year when it regulated private citizens who transport individuals incarcerated or those who have warrants issued against them. However, we realized that this exemption did not extend to federal law enforcement agents who also transport incarcerated individuals throughout the state. DOC does utilize the services of our partners at the U.S. Marshal's Office to conduct some of these transports on our behalf when someone is being transported to or from a federal facility or to and from another state. This bill explicitly adds federal law enforcement officers to the group of individuals providing security or transportation services in these instances, allowing them to not have to get licensed as protective agents. The second part of this bill makes refinements to the community supervision statutes. Specifically, it updates the reporting dates for statewide community supervision reports and consolidates these reports in a logical manner. By doing so, we believe we will enhance the meaningfulness of the information coming to the legislature. This change is important as it will help ensure that we are providing accurate, timely, and relevant information regarding community supervision efforts in Minnesota. The third aspect of this bill is the adjustment to the membership of the Community Supervision Advisory Council, or CSAC. I do have Assistant Commissioner Kelly Mitchell from DOC here today who worked on these supervision changes as well. As requested by the Advisory Council, the bill expands CSAC's membership to include members of the judicial branch, which will help ensure that the council has this perspective and expertise when making these recommendations. Additionally, this bill expands certain membership requirements for public members to ensure adequate representation on the council. This change is also in direct response to the feedback we received from CSAC. Lastly, this bill proposes the repeal of Minnesota Statutes 253.21 and 253.23. These statutes are over 100 years old and were brought to light during the separation of DHS and direct care and treatment last year when this language was amended rather than repealed. The statutes require Stillwater and St. Cloud prisons, and only these two prisons, to notify DCT when incarcerated individuals appear to have a mental illness and to transfer them to state hospitals for treatment. This requirement is very outdated and no longer aligns with how the state handles mental health care in prisons. In closing, the changes in this bill are technical in nature, but they are necessary to ensure that the DOC operates effectively and efficiently. Thank you, and I stand for any questions you may have.
Thanks for your testimony, Deputy Commissioner. Any questions for the bill author or DOC? Representative Pinto.
Not a question. I just want to comment that in my years here, this is the best handout I've ever seen for a technical bill. I'm just very, for a technical bill, very impressive. So thank you, DOC, for work, and thank you, Representative Curran.
All right. Any other discussions before we move to the amendment? All right. Next, we're going to move to the A1 amendment. And the A1 amendment incorporates language from the Representative Keeler bill that we just heard, House File 1265. The purpose of the amendment is to combine the two DOC policies into one bill. So that's what we would be doing here. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendment? All right, seeing none, I will move the A1 amendment. Those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. All right, any other member discussion to the bill as amended? All right, Representative Curran, closing comments.
Thank you again, Chair and members, for considering the DOC technical bill and appreciating the fine handout that we got from the department. I also appreciate that. As stated, this puts statutes in alignment with current practice and brings our language to the best it can be today. And I
thank you. Representative Curran renews the motion to recommend that House File 1659 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And now that we amended it, you're going to have to add another little section here on the handout for the floor. So, all right, the next bill we have up is House File 1094, Representative Holland's bill. And as you get up to the table, Representative Holland's, would you like to, let's see, recommend that House File 1094 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion.
All right, and there is an amendment, and what the plan is for you to just move the amendment. We're not going to vote on that now. So would you like to move the amendment? And I want to make sure I have the right number here. It's the A250017 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I would.
All right. So now your bill is before us, and then we'll take care of the amendments later. You could please go ahead and explain your bill.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, committee members. This is the Cannabis Expungement Board Technical Changes Bill. So as you all probably remember, in 2023, we passed cannabis legalization, and as a part of that, we created a program to expunge those cannabis convictions that had happened previously. So as a part of that bill that we passed, there was also, we passed a board, the Cannabis Expungement Board, to review past felony level cannabis convictions for possible expungement or resentencing. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has identified 98,000 cases for the board to review, so they've got a heavy lift. The eligibility for expungement includes the absence of weapons or violence involvement, and that act must be less than felony level under current law. The board must also conduct a multi-part analysis that includes public safety considerations. After getting the office established, the board was recently reviewing cases, and there were several oversights in the legislation, and decision by the courts has resulted in the board not being able to review many cases that the legislature intended. This legislation is intended to resolve those issues. And I can, along with the amendment, I'll go through what it does, if that's okay.
That's fine, yep.
And I'll be very brief, so I'll give you something more to say. So really what we're trying to do here, we want to capture some of the cannabis offenses that were unintentionally missed in the drafting of the original legislation. There were, for example, fifth degree sales was omitted in the legislation, and so making sure that we're capturing all of those cannabis offenses. The second thing is to address the issue of the courts not sealing records in multi-court cases. And the third one is including historic cannabis offenses that might not be included in statute. I believe the problem was that when we created the legislature, we cited statute that only went back to 1989, and in fact, there are cannabis charges that could have happened before then that wouldn't be included in that expungement process. So with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers. Testifier.
Okay, yeah. Mr. Hazy, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for taking the time to consider this bill. My name is Mark Hazy. I'm the Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Cannabis Expungement Board. I'm joined by our Director, Jim Rauter, who is here if any of you have any questions about the office overall. But for time's sake, I'll just cover the bill. Representative Hollins covered it well and succinctly. I mean, simply put, as sometimes happens with legislation, once you start looking at it, especially something this complex, you might find that some things were missed. So I think it's pretty clear from the way the bill is written that the intent of the legislature had been for the board to review all past felony-level cannabis offenses. And that, as Representative Hollins said, you know, they're only eligible if they don't involve violence, they don't involve a firearm as well, and if under current law they're less than felony level. So that still applies, but the legislation just missed something. So that's kind of the basic part of the bill. There's an additional part that Representative Hollins mentioned that's come up since the law was passed, and that's that last year the courts issued an administrative order that said in multi-count cases, they are not able to expunge even one of those counts that would be eligible under the automatic expungement, cannabis expungement statute. And in subsequent conversations with them, they said that that would apply once we start asking to have the felony cannabis offenses expunged. And so let me just give you a little more detail on that. I know I've talked to some members and there's concerns about this part of the bill. The court organizes their information by case. And in any given case, you could have one to any number of counts within that case, right? If somebody's charged with two things as part of that case, let's say they're pulled over for speeding and they also possess some cannabis, but so there's two counts in that case, right? The speeding is dismissed, the cannabis conviction, the person is convicted of the cannabis offense, that's eligible under our statute. They will not, even if we say that that should be expunged, they will not do it because they say they can't separate those out. The dismissed case would be, is public information, so they have to keep the whole thing open. Now, if that same person, say the officer pulled that person over and for whatever reason decided not to cite the person for speeding, but they cited them for the cannabis, then in that case, that could be expunged. So it creates this unequal result. I know there's concerns based on the conversations I've had about what else might have happened there. You know, a couple things to remember are that if there's violence involved again, weapons involvement, that would not be eligible. These are dismissed cases. This would only apply to dismissed counts or counts that are otherwise eligible under the automatic cannabis expungement misdemeanors. So nothing else would be eligible. Also, the board would still have to make the determination looking at the totality of the circumstances around various public safety considerations. So I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that part of the bill. And with that, I'll remain for questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anybody from the public wishing to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing any. So next, we will move to the A1 amendment. Who will be offering the A1?
That would be me, Madam Chair.
All right. Chair Novotny to the A1.
Madam Chair, we have the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment to the A25-0017 removes the language that grants the cannabis board to expunge or resentence multiple count cases beyond cannabis offenses. The Minnesota Supreme Court issued an administrative order concerning cannabis review that states the judicial branch shall only expunge cases if the entire case qualifies. We think this understanding makes most sense and keeps with the CEB with the intent in purview.
expanding the CEB's power over charges unrelated to cannabis could have unintended consequences. For example, if an offender is convicted of a marijuana possession charge where more serious drug charges were dismissed as part of the plea deal, this could give the CEB power to resentence or expunge an already dismissed sentences. And for example, we look at lines of the amendment 250017, 2.5 and 2.6, 3.20, 3.21, 4.11, and 4.12. Basically, our amendment takes this amendment back to the original bill, which we feel does enough to satisfy the requirements that they need for clarification in them to the go ahead with their work as the board and do these expungements. We already know from testimony and different committees that they have more than enough to keep them busy for a long time just on the cases that already fit the constraints of the bill as it is. And we think that the amendment narrows the scope of the bill and allows the CEB to do the work that they should do effectively, and I ask for your support.
All right, Representative Hollins to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm of course a little disappointed that we couldn't move forward with the bill as amended. However, I understand there's been conversations happening. I hope to continue those conversations, and I hope that we eventually get to peace in the valley like you did. So I would encourage members to accept the A1 amendment to the amendment.
All right. Further discussion to the amendment to the amendment. All right. I want to make sure I have this right, so hold on one second here. All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to the A250017 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Hollins moves the A250017 amendment as amended. Any more discussion to the amendment as amended? Oh, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to expound upon Co-Chair Novotny's point regarding the current workload that the expungement board has. In judiciary, we heard a presentation from the board where they noted that the BCA has identified 98,000 potential cases that require review. At current staffing levels, this was in their presentation, they're able to process 100 cases per month. If you do the math on that, we're talking about over 80 years that it's going to take the board to complete this. Now, I understand they're not at full capacity yet, and that's going to change the numbers. But just to emphasize what Chair Novotny was saying, they got plenty on their plate as it is. I understand that's not necessarily a reason to not do this, but it is noteworthy. So thank you.
Representative Hollins, did you have a response to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. I agree, right? As I said, it's a hefty lift. That being said, I think, you know, the intention of, I know, I was part of the conference committee for the cannabis bill, and so I know that the intention was to, in fact, expunge these additional, these additional charges that we were trying to include here. And so I think because of that, because the legislative intention was to actually free people from this burden that we've now legalized, that is the reason why I would like to continue working on it and moving forward on that.
May I make a comment, Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Representative Hudson, I just want to make sure that the public's aware that, as you said, the 100 a month amount is what we're doing right now. With 9 staff, and those are 4-5 legal staff, including myself. The plan over the next 4 to 6 months, if hiring goes well, is to get up to more like 25 legal staff. And we also have just developed a process for the board to look at, you know, for the staff to review certain things and the board to look at these in a much larger amounts at a time. So we're hoping to get to many hundreds of cases within the next year. We know that 100 a month is just not going to cut it. I would note also that this, you know, difference of cases where there might be multi counts and only one count will make that go a little bit slower. And again, it will create this sort of inequitable result depending on kind of what happened in your case, right? So as Representative Hollins mentioned, if you know, I would be happy to continue talking with folks to see if there's some way we can work this out so it's a little more streamlined and fair. Thanks.
Anything else, Representative Hudson? Nope. Any further member discussion? Yep, Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Hollins, just please understand, we understand what you're trying to say, and we do want to streamline this. We don't want this to take some time into the next decade. Just feel that the language in your amendment has the chance to be misinterpreted or expanded upon where it doesn't necessarily mean to go. We understand the scope, not that we need to take it up now, but you know, we can, as this moves along, and we can clarify it in a different session, but we just want to make sure that it's not going places it's not supposed to. So with that, I recommend a green vote.
Great, and before I turn it to closing comments, I just have to say thank you to Mr. Johnson for your continued work on the cannabis bills, and to all our nonpartisan staff always who really help us a lot. All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Novotny. I appreciate your willingness to continue having conversations about this and working on it. I do truly believe that we can figure out a way to move forward and get to peace in the valley. So thank you so much for everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Hollins renews the motion to recommend that House File 1094 as amended be placed on the general register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And the final bill on the calendar for today is House File 686, a Representative Frazier bill. He was here. Oh, there he is. All right. And we will be laying over House File 686. I will move to lay over House File 686. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Frazier. It's nice to see you.
It's like deja vu.
I don't see any amendments to your bills, so whenever you're ready, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Don't do it. Sorry, Madam Chair. Go ahead. I'm being distracted up here by members hazing me in my first day back.
All right, Representative Frazier, whenever you're ready to tell
Thank
us about
you.
Your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, appreciate, and members, co-vice chairs, I appreciate the time to have this discussion on this bill. I've been working on traffic safety issues since I've gotten into the legislature with unfortunate incidents that happened, namely, the loss of Dante Wright.
Sorry, your mic may not be picking up online.
How about now?
That's good.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So I've been working on these issues since I've come to the legislature, and I'm happy to keep working on them. I think there's a lot of things that we can do to improve our safety in the state, and so I'm looking forward to this conversation. I'll have a short intro, and I'll make sure we get to our testifiers, which are really good testifiers. So, you know, public safety works best when there's trust between law enforcement in the communities they serve. House File 686 is a necessary step towards ensuring every traffic stop in Minnesota is conducted fairly, professionally, and safely, with an emphasis on constitutional protections. This bill creates clear standardized guidelines to promote accountability, reduce disparities, and strengthen public confidence in law enforcement. Right now, traffic stop procedures vary across the state, leading to racial disparities. There's one study, black and indigenous drivers are stopped and searched at higher rates than white drivers, despite lower rates of contraband discovery based on data. House File 686 ensures that every Minnesotan is treated equitably, no matter their race or where they live, by establishing clear, consistent protocols that prevent racial profiling and unnecessary escalations. Standardized procedures do not take away officer discretion. They strengthen it. House File 686 provides officers with research-backed best practices, just as use of force and crisis intervention training does. When officers have clear guidelines, they are better equipped to make sound decisions under pressure, ensuring safer and more effective interactions. Traffic stops can be unpredictable and high stakes. I've heard from many officers that have talked about the dangerous situations that they can be put in. But inconsistent procedures increase risk for both officers and civilians. House File 686 prioritizes safety by ensuring all officers receive the same training on de-escalation, situational awareness, and community engagement, proven strategies that we know protect everyone involved. Minnesota's law enforcement agencies serve diverse communities. We understand that, and this bill acknowledges that. House File 686 would establish a strong statewide foundation for fairness and safety while allowing departments to implement additional training that fits their specific needs. So it creates, 686 would create a floor, would not prevent any of the law enforcement agencies from around this state from doing more to adapt to and be specific to their communities. House File 686, it's not about red tape. It's about ensuring that every Minnesotan can trust that traffic stops are conducted with fairness and professionalism. Public safety depends on strong relationships between officers and communities. And by working together to establish clear expectations, we can make Minnesota a leader in equitable, effective policing. And with that, I'll turn my time over to my very, very capable testifiers here.
All right, thank you. It looks like Valerie Castile, welcome to the committee. It's nice to see you. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm glad you remember me. Thank you guys for allowing me to testify today. My name is Valerie Castile, and I hope you guys remember my son, Philando Castile, who was killed by a police officer in Falcon Heights, July the 6th, 2016. After Philando was killed, I started working vividly with you guys down here at the legislative departments, the police and law enforcement, and I've traveled and talked about traffic safety, you know, safe traffic stops. That's what I want to say. And it's very, very important that everybody is protected. We're not saying one person versus the other person. It's about safety all around. And that's what I've been advocating for the last 9 years, unfortunately. But I think this model would be a great model because it signifies that the police officers are trained and everybody knows the standard. If you have something so simple as universal hand washing, where it protects thousands, millions of people, why don't we have some type of universal foundation, a model for policing? We all want to go home at the end of the day at that traffic stop. We all want to go home. And if we got some type of protocol where it's educational-wise, you know, you can build off of this model. It's doable. It's flexible to be tailored to any department, but at least you have a model. You have some type of foundation to build off of because we're all human, and we just want the best for Minnesota policing and all across the United States. And I've been working really, really hard at that, you know, with John Jay Criminal College, different working groups and panels, talking about the alliances for safe traffic stops. So I'm here to support the bill because this is something that we need. You know, we're not eliminating anybody. We're not saying anybody's doing anything wrong. But if we have a model that we can subsequently re-educate, you know, in as far as the training is concerned, and just build and be able to live in peace and harmony. You know, that's what I'm all about. I've never had a problem with law enforcement. I love talking to you guys so that we all can be on the same page. So if you, you know, I encourage you to read the bill and look at it objectively as well as subjectively and come up with a decision and we can move forward and everybody will be safe. That's what it's all about, public safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony and also for the advocacy you do to make sure kids are fed in school in memory of your son. So appreciate all your advocacy that you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Kelly Moore. If you could please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Moore. I'm the Deputy Director of Legislation for the Policing Project at NYU School of Law and a Minneapolis resident. As Representative Frazier indicated over previous years, and even in this session, this committee has heard a number of policies directed at improving traffic stops. You've looked at limiting traffic stops, increasing the penalties for leaving a traffic stop, altering how consent searches work, and much more. HF 686 would allow the POST board to create a model baseline policy that could address all of those issues and more. Setting forth this kind of baseline policy will not prevent police from being flexibly responsive to the situation that is in front of them, but it will ensure that each traffic stop in Minnesota is performed to a minimum standard of efficacy, professionalism, and safety. This bill could improve a number of problems that exist with traffic stops. As you all know, both nationwide and within Minnesota, black drivers and other drivers of color are stopped at rates disproportionate to their populations. And once a stop happens, non-white drivers are searched, arrested, and subjected to force more often than white drivers. Setting forth clear statewide standards could help limit biased or disparate enforcement. This bill could also reduce the risk of violence during traffic stops. Every year, motorists and officers are killed during stops, as Ms. Castile so movingly reminded us. A model policy that addresses de-escalation, communication, and mental health crises will make these interactions less fraught and hopefully less risky for all involved. A model policy can also put in place best practices around preventing drive-offs and resulting pursuits. POST could examine recent recommendations from experts in law enforcement about tactics to prevent pursuits, like tire deflation devices, police cruiser positioning, and GPS tracking, and incorporate which of those ideas are workable for Minnesota agencies and officers. For all these reasons and more, HF 686 will make traffic stops work better for police, for drivers, and communities across the state. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. I know Chief Potts signed up to testify, and also Eric Misselt. So if you both want to come on up to the testifier table.
You're going to let them sit down.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Right. And our other testifiers, you can stay close by in case we need to call you back up. You just have a seat. All right. Welcome back to the committee, Chief. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Potts. I represent the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association as their executive director, and I will try to be brief here. I know that in your packet is a letter that is from the Minnesota Sheriffs Association as well as MPPOA, which opposes this bill, and for many of the same reasons that are cited in the letter, the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association also opposes the bill. And just to add a little bit of context, I'm here today to share with you the reasons for that. And primarily, it's not because we don't think traffic safety is important. It's not because we don't think that everyone should go home safely after a traffic stop. It's quite the contrary, actually. But over the last few years, there have been a number of model policies and required trainings put forward and required now by police officers throughout the state. We try to train police officers in certain skills that apply to every activity that they do, whether it be responding to a suspicious person or conducting a traffic stop, investigating a burglary, dealing with shoplifting incidents. The model policies that are currently required that actually are I think hit 6 of the 8 provisions in subdivision 2 of this bill, they're already required to have a professional conduct of police officers or standard of conduct model policy. There's a model policy required for avoiding racial profiling. There's a model policy required for what to do with or how to deal with the vehicle that flees, or a pursuit model policy. There's use of force model policy. There's also a policy that is required regarding body-worn camera or portable recording devices. There's also already required training in the area of conflict management and mediation, crisis intervention, and mental illness crisis. Recognizing and valuing community diversity and cultural differences to include implicit bias, autism, crimes motivated by bias, use of force, and emergency vehicle operations course. Now, those 8 required or 7 required trainings, again, in part in combination with the model policies that are already in place, touch on most of the provisions in this bill. I'll wrap up by saying I think, in our opinion at the Minnesota Chiefs Association, I think we would be served well to actually focus on the training more so than the policy. There is a training program called the Philando Castile Training Fund, which has been funded by this legislature for a number of years. Came out of the Philando Castile. We just heard his mother testify here today. It shows the importance that law enforcement in partnership with our community put on training. I think our association feels strongly that we're better served to focus on that training. Unfortunately, it's not funded in the governor's current budget. There is a bill in this committee that was laid over a few weeks ago to fund that. That money goes only in specifically for the training, the types of training that I talked about right here. It was titled the Philando Castile Training Fund. We strongly encourage this committee to support that, continue supporting that training fund, because we think that is essentially what is extremely important when it comes to everyone going home safely at the end of a traffic stop or any encounter with law enforcement. Madam Chair, thank you for your time here today and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. And I just verified with the revised governor's budget, I think he put $2 million one time, which wasn't your ask, but just wanted to make sure that was known, that there was he did include a little bit in the revised budget.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, the appropriation has been $6 million since 2017. There was $1 million put forth in the revised budget, so we still sit about $5 million short in the revised budget that at the current time anyway.
All right. Let's see. Executive Director Missel, please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. for the record, I stand for questions mostly. I was asked to come and testify. As you know, I think most of you know on this committee, POST generally is Switzerland on these things. We will implement what you tell us to implement. I'll just offer additional, just one additional piece along the lines of what Chief Potts expressed. We do have many policies that we currently enforce. Many of them cover some of the same topic areas, but I will let you all argue about whether or not they do that adequately. And I just want to remind the committee that with regard to policy is exactly that, is guidelines. It is generally not operational procedure. And from a POST standpoint, in terms of enforcing policy, that is enforced against the CLIO. In other words, they have to adopt the policy and follow it. But just understand that any potential issues that come out of violation of a particular model policy are the responsibility of the CLIO or the local agency. There are no licensing sanctions tied to violation of these model policies. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we move to member questions, I guess I do have a question about what kind of training does law enforcement get now when it comes specifically to traffic stops? I know, Chief Potts, you mentioned a lot of other trainings that are currently given that are included in this bill, but I'm just curious about traffic stops specifically, and is there any sort of uniform training, or is it just up to each agency? And I don't know who. Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, I can attempt to answer that in terms of what I'll call the in-service training is, and maybe Mr. Missel can address the pre-service. But there, whenever an officer is hired, they go through many weeks of what we call field training, and a fair amount of that time is spent on how to safely conduct a traffic stop. Typically, that field training has several different phases. Traffic stops is addressed in every phase of that training. Each police officer is required to attend emergency vehicle operations training throughout their career. I think it's now currently required every 5 years. And a portion of that emergency vehicle operations training is focused on safe position of vehicles, I think was mentioned earlier by one of the testifiers. Agencies conduct in-service training on an annual basis. So if there's a new law that is passed that specifically addresses traffic stops, each year they will work in partnership with oftentimes the League of Minnesota Cities or their insurance provider on developing curriculum that will address those new law changes or best practices. And so each agency will conduct annual in-service training. Again, a portion of that is typically directed towards traffic stops. So traffic stops is not something that is not trained often. It may not be exactly the same from one community to the next, depending on the dynamics and the variables. You know, is it a rural community? Is it a very urban community? But I would say traffic stop training is conducted formally and informally very frequently by police officers after they are hired and become a police officer.
All right. Moving on to other member questions, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Frazier, for the bill and for this discussion. We chatted a little bit earlier today And I appreciate that conversation we had, because I too was just, you know, I have concerns when we want to try to prescribe how we do things within agencies, right? But after our conversation and looking more at the bill language, to me, it seems like model policies at all agencies essentially already exist. There's basic training that already exists. To me, it seems like what you're asking for is to have the post board just sort of have that neatly available to folks, just like a basic guidance policy. I don't have any disagreement with that. I think that's a good thing. And not to say that good practices aren't being taught and done, but I think in the interest of getting the public on board with, you know, when we're saying like, oh, the police departments are doing the training, they are doing the training, and they're doing an excellent and rigorous job at training in 99.9% of the cases, right? But there's still that general public sort of perception of what is happening in that training, what's being taught. And I think, honestly, just putting that on paper or making that available to people helps them understand the process a little better and might alleviate some of the distrust issues that we're trying to focus on. And so I appreciate it in that sense that I see it more as a sort of stepping up our education to the public of this is what we expect from public safety, this is how folks are trained and how we expect stops to go. Not being super prescriptive in it, right? Saying like, you pull the vehicle over in a safe location and you're not gonna exactly say what angle the car should be at and how far. And that's up to a department. There are regional issues that you have to deal with. Sometimes wherever you're working, you know that like it just doesn't work to pull somebody over in a certain spot right next to a lake or by a business. Like those are regional things or local things you work out. And so I think for people who start their career in Minnesota and go through the pre-service training programs that we were talking about, and you know, Chair Moeller, to sort of your comments earlier, you know, I sort of like, I tried not to chuckle when you asked about training on traffic stops, because as somebody who went through the Minnesota version of school, this is like what you do every single day in skills. And then just the practices get, the hands-on practices get increasingly more complex as you sort of move through that process. So you learn about more complex traffic stops. You move from rolling a stop sign and speeding to then that same offense, but now there's drugs in the car. Or now you're upping it to, okay, now we're dealing with a stolen vehicle. How do you do a felony stop, right? And so for folks that go through pre-service training, it is extensive. It addresses as many situations as we can possibly try to replicate in training, understanding that every situation is unique, right? And I don't think what we're looking for here is to prescribe every single traffic stop and what you should do in each scenario. That's not my understanding, and that's why I'm comfortable with this bill, is just saying, look, we're already doing, there's clearly already a way to stop a car that's pretty universal, at least in the state of Minnesota. Put it on paper, let people read about it, and also let departments address issues that are specific to their area. So I thank you for the clarification and for sort of alleviating some of my concerns with it. I'm good with it as is, and I appreciate transparency in the process. So thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, it's like old times. Public safety is not the same without you, so welcome back. So I'll start by correcting the record a little bit. So it's been suggested that this is a guidance policy. It's something for people to look at and kind of think about and, you know, maybe do something with. But of course, in lines 3.9 through 3.12, it says that by September 1st of 2026, each law enforcement agency in the state shall develop, adopt, and implement a written policy regarding traffic stops that is identical or substantially similar to the model policy developed under subsection 2. And we've also heard speculation as to what the policy may be and what it may not be. The fact of the matter is we don't know.
That's correct.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We don't know what they're going to come up with. So just on that basis alone, this isn't something that I can personally support, because I can't vote for something that I have to pass in order to find out what's in it, right? That kind of underlying principle. But beyond that, there's some conceptual problems that I have with this as well, and they've been articulated by Chief Potts fairly well in terms of this being a one-size-fits-all proposal. Whatever they come up with, there's no way that it's going to address the disparate needs that officers have. This joint letter that we have in our packet from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, they say traffic stops are also one of the most unpredictable and potentially dangerous aspects of policing. Officers rely on extensive training, experience, and discretion to assess each situation in real time. Further down, they say, additionally, this bill does not acknowledge that Minnesota's law enforcement agencies already provide extensive training on traffic stops, de-escalation tactics, and community engagement. And so it seems like a solution in search of a problem. What I do know, I don't know what the final policy that comes out of POST will be, but what I do know is that based upon the language of the bill, it's going to be rooted in two assumptions that I fundamentally disagree with. The first assumption is that the mere existence of a racial disparity means there's racism taking place or racial profiling taking place. It is possible for a group of people to more frequently engage in certain activities than another group of people. And if you could point me to examples of people who were completely innocent, who didn't escalate the situation, and that's the other assumption that I fundamentally disagree with, is this idea that everybody wants to go home safe. Clearly they don't. There are bad actors in the world. There are people. At de-escalation, it takes two to tango there. Both people have to want to be safe. If the subject in a traffic stop doesn't care about their safety or the safety of others, they are going to take action that endangers that officer, themselves, people around them. And you know, this claim of people being unarmed, you're in a massive vehicle compared to a person with the ability to travel at high speed. That's a weapon if you choose to use it as such. So I just think this bill is trying to solve a problem that doesn't currently exist. We have training. Our officers do want to de-escalate. That's the other assumption that kind of seems to be implicit in this, is that officers are just looking for an opportunity to draw down on a guy. That is not how they want to end their day, especially in this environment. So I don't think we need a statewide one-size-fits-all model policy in order to encourage de-escalation. But it is great to see you again. Thanks.
Representative Frazier, would you like to address that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hudson, I appreciate the question. What I would say is that it's not a one-size-fits-all. I mean, the whole idea of the policy is to have the Post Board develop this model policy with the input from law enforcement agencies, and that could be law enforcement agencies from all over the state. In my opening comments, I acknowledge that there's diversity within these communities. There's differences within these communities. I don't expect the folks up in Stevens County to be the same as the folks in Hennepin County, or Ramsey County, or Anoka County, or Blue Earth County, or Nicollet County. But what I do expect is that we can create some kind of floor to where there's an expectation. There's a base level, baseline expectation that the community can have, and that officers can have, and that folks can know what that is. That's the transparency piece. And then if there's things that folks need to focus on that are unique to their community, they absolutely can do that. This would not get rid of that discretion. This would not create any kind of caps on how they do that. This would not take away their discretion at all. So I think we often say one size fits all here a lot. I'm hearing that a lot here, right? And then I go back and I read the bill and I look at things, and there's all kind of caveats and off ramps and off roads. And I'm like, how is this one size fits all? But I think we always say that to get away from the real conversation and the real discussions that need to be had to talk about the uniqueness of our different communities and to find that common ground that we need to find to ensure that we can work together and have the trust and accountability that's necessary so that law enforcement and communities can have that harmony that Ms. Castillo talked about. So that's what I'm looking for here. I'm not shutting anyone out. This bill doesn't even prescribe who has to be communicated with by the Post Board. It just says go out and talk to everybody. And include that as part of the conversation when you create this model policy. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it. Many of the things that are acknowledged in the bill, there may be training on that. But as Chief Potts said, it's different depending on where that agency is. And I think that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. That's why we're going to bring everyone together to be a part of this conversation. I think everyone can agree with that. We've had conversations recently that folks weren't invited to the conversation. So I'm making sure, I've always been one that invites everybody to the conversation. And I don't think anyone here can say that I have not done that. I've had recent conversations with members in your caucus to talk about this. And what do I always say? Bring an amendment. Ask questions. We can work through this together to figure out what the best thing is and how we can find a common ground to continue to work in this. So while the bill's being laid over, I'm looking forward to continuing to have those conversations.
Thank you. And I'll note that we need to wrap by 4:50, and we have four members on, so five now. And I want to make sure we get to all those questions. So what I'll do is we'll have each member talk, and then unless you have specific questions for the bill author or other testifiers, Representative Frazier will have you do a summary at the end when you do your closing. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Obviously, traffic stops are probably one of the, I can't tell you how many I did in my career, but they were probably the ones that were the most unpredictable. And you know they can change in a moment, and probably the ones that are unsafe. What I am concerned about a little bit is, and maybe Mr. Missel can talk about this, continuing education requirements. I think that's going to put a lot of burden on our police departments, especially after we had some good policy and it's been cut from the governor's budget. And what's that going to put the shift to? The other part I have is the model policy developed by the board. It's with law enforcement agencies, traffic safety experts, community organization, and other relevant stakeholders. Unless you've been in the boots of an officer on a traffic stop, and know what you need to do to get home, I don't know what value it's going to bring in all these different groups and not being out on that traffic stop. They might think their intentions are good, but it could cause unintended consequences, and it could put our officers in jeopardy. So that was my first question for Mr. Missel. And then I do have one follow-up because I got a solution for you, Representative Frazier.
Executive Director Missel.
Okay, I will do my best, particularly on the subpart six or subdivision six, the continuing education piece. I will acknowledge, knowing how these processes work, some, not that we can't do it, but some concern about how this is putting it on the board, and I understand it's part of our responsibility, the board's responsibility, to determine really additional training. Now, as to how that affects individual agencies and the whole funding bit, again, that's a battle for others. We will administer whatever funding you send. But it's kind of ironic because I know there have been times in the past where it's been very prescriptive. And so in one respect, that doesn't allow flexibility, but in this other respect, it made it very clear what we were to put in for the training. This leaves it a little more open. Not saying we can't do it, but again, the board would ultimately be responsible for deciding what burden or how heavy a burden is put on agencies in terms of training and figuring out how this fits with the other mandates that are already in there. I hope that answers your question, sir.
Thank you.
And Representative Witte, yes, and we have another member on your side wants to talk too. So
I'll make this quick. Okay. So my solution, I truly believe it's a privilege to drive in the state of Minnesota. It's not a right, and we have to take that responsibility very seriously. We have something called the Minnesota Driver's Manual, and within it, it talks about passing a parked emergency service vehicle, following firefighting vehicle, what to do and expect when stopped by law enforcement. If you look at page 55 through 58 in the manual, it has a lot of good things for when you are behind the wheel on a traffic stop. Don't reach around the vehicle. If you need to reach, make sure you contact the officer. Keep your hands on the steering wheel. All these different pieces in here that are people are going through. Maybe they need to be renewed every time they go get their driver's license and they sign off and understand that they do play a part in these traffic stops. And it could help the basic traffic stop go smoother. So Just a suggestion.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am one of those guys that you talked to for a very long time yesterday about this bill. Traffic stops were my thing when I was a cop. And that was one of the things I loved doing. But when I look at this from the cop side of things, it's you're trying to legislate morality. You're trying to legislate people's feelings and thoughts and reactions to certain situations and particular times and how to do this stuff. And we're not going to get there. And, you know, when me and you talked about this yesterday, I said one of the things that we can do to actually improve the law enforcement and general public's ability to, I guess, mend some relationships is getting out there and being in the public and being part of that, being a part of that fix. But that also comes with the legislation, making sure that we are supporting our law enforcement and our general public the same, right? This bill, coming from a cop standpoint, it's like you're attacking police officers because they're not doing the things that you want them to do in a way that you want them to conduct themselves. And, you know, and I've asked you, you know, yesterday, and you told me to bring it up today, so this would be my question to you. You know, if we see that there's an issue with traffic stops, or you know that there's an issue with what you believe to be problems with traffic stops, why don't we start when they start, you know, young in their career, which is in schools? Like, have you thought about approaching the schools and seeing if we can get on a cohesive environment and training these young officers coming up and working on that side of things?
Representative Frazier.
I have not looked specifically at that. I think that's a good idea. Are you going to bring an amendment or something? I mean, that's... Thank you, Chair. I haven't looked specifically at that, but I think that's great, right? But I also think that for those, for that generation or the generations that we have not captured, how do we address that? We have to do it with the training that they get on a year-to-year basis once they are out of school and into the workforce and actually doing the work in real time. So I think that's important. I think it's great to start early on up front as they're going through the education process to get their degrees to be eligible. But then for those folks that haven't gone through that process, we have to capture them as well. And that's why I think this 686 would be a good start. And again, I consider this to be a facilitation of those conversations and engagement. That's why, to Representative Whitty's comment, that's why you invite these other individuals to speak to that. We may say they may have never walked in the shoes of an officer, but every day they walk in the shoes of a civilian, and we're here to serve civilians.
Great. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill forward and for having this conversation, which I know is difficult. And it's a difficult conversation for me to have, and I'm trying to remain calm and cool because I am hearing a lot of things that just aren't making a ton of sense to me. And, you know, I think this is an important piece of legislation because it's not a solution in search of a problem. We know, we have data that show that black and brown people are more likely to be pulled over even when there is nothing happening, or when the same things that are happening are done equally between white and black people or white and brown people. We know that Philando Castile, who was shot on the edge of my district, it was a 40-second interaction, and he was killed in front of his child. This is not a solution in search of a problem. This is a real problem. When my father comes to visit me, I have to give him a slip of paper that says this is his name and he's allowed to drive this car, just in case he gets pulled over, because I don't want anything to happen to him as a black man. Like, this is not a solution in search of a problem. This is a real problem. And I think, by my reading of this bill, we are looking at something that, to Representative Hudson's point, is not yet defined, and therefore cannot be one size fits all, because it is not yet defined. And I think it's very respectful and responsible to not define that currently, because you're right, there are differences. What happens in my district is going to be different than what happens in Crystal, which is going to be different than what happens in Duluth. And I think that's actually looking at a problem in a really responsible way. But I want to be clear, this is a problem, and it might not be a problem that everybody sees, and maybe it's not a problem in your community, but it is a real problem, and we have data and statistics to back us up on that. So I'm going to leave it at that, but I really appreciate you and what you're doing. And the other thing I want to say is, you know, I'm hearing, like, you don't know what it's like to be law enforcement and do what you need to do to make sure you go home. Well, what are you going to say to Ms. Castile, whose son didn't come home? What did he do wrong that made it so that he didn't ever get to go home? We have to look at both sides of it. And I recognize that I need to look at it from the law enforcement side as well, because I don't understand it and I haven't done it. But I need law enforcement to look at it from the other side too, because we are scared and we are trying to do everything that's right. Philando tried to do what was right, and he still didn't make it home. So how do we get there? And what I see from this bill is we are trying to create some guidelines about what you need to do, and if somebody doesn't follow it, then they get in trouble. And I think that's responsible. We all have it in our professions. As lawyers, if we don't do the thing we're supposed to do, we get in trouble for it. You know, we all have responsibilities for this, and I think this is just good policy. And yes, there are probably some tweaks that still need to be worked out, and I totally acknowledge that, and I want to continue having this conversation with the entire group. But I really need all of us to see both sides of the situation. Thank you.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Maya is just mainly a comment, because the bill talks about racial profiling. But I just want to talk a little bit, just a short minute here, about profiling in general. You might not know, but I am a member of ABATE, which is a motorcycle group. You might look at me and think, I can't believe that she's a motorcyclist, but I am. And what I just want to relay is what I've heard from some members from my group is that sometimes that they do feel that they are stopped just because of the way that they look driving down the street. And so maybe that's something that needs to be looked at, too. I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, it's nice to see you again. It's been a little while. How you doing?
Good.
No, I just want to touch on a couple of points here. First off, the money for this. We have 8,000 cops that are going to have to go through different training now. If this is this standard, which we don't know what it is, but if it does go into law, we don't have that money here, right? So can we address that a little bit?
Representative Frazier.
Yeah, I think that when there is money in the bill for posts to administer the training. There is money there. There is a dollar amount listed there. But I do think that's something we have to look at, and I'm open to looking at that. I think we have to prioritize where we spend our money. I think this should be one of those priorities. I think Chief Potts mentioned here about the Philando Castile Memorial Fund. Ms. Castile mentioned that to me on the way in. We were having a conversation that there's resources there. But I think it's a tough decision. You all going to have to make a decision about that when you prioritize your budget. But I'm looking forward to being a part of that, continue to be a part of that conversation.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it seems like the money that's appropriated here is just going towards the implementation of, the creation of a policy that we don't know of yet, a standard that we don't know of yet. And you're right, there is some money that's hopefully going to be in the Philando Castile Training Fund, but like Mr. Potts said, it's only $2 million instead of $6 million, in accordance with the governor's budget here. But another question here for you, if that's all right. I just want to apply the same standard that we've heard several times in this committee in dealing with different pieces of legislation. Did you consult with the experts in the field who are dealing with this every single day, MPPOA, sheriffs, chiefs, post board? Did you consult with them before bringing this bill forward?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Egan, in the bill, it specifically, it does prescribe that the post board would have to, as part of the conversation, they would have to consult with law enforcement. That is the intent of that.
All right, we really are like beyond time, so can you just wrap it up?
Yeah, I just thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. you said that you wanted to invite everybody to the table, but not everybody has been invited to the decision table. You're listening to people, but then never actually addressing their concerns. So for that reason alone, I'm going to be voting no on this. Thank you.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, and thank you, Chair. I'm glad that Ms. Castile has made it back into the room. I was afraid that you had left. I'm glad you made it back. What I want to offer to you is this, is that, unfortunately, Representative Hollins has left. I'm going to have to agree with her for the second time in the session that this is not a solution in search for problem. There is a problem. There will always be a problem. Whatever level we're at, we can get better. But I will say that, Ms. Castile, if there's anything you can take from today or any lessons that you can learn, or if it gives you any solace, that we are doing better. We've got the fund. I'm fighting for that fund to keep the training in your son's name. Executive Director Potts covered all my points on the thing, so I won't have to cover all the policy things that have put into post board since then. I would offer a suggestion, Representative Fraser, if you want to sit down with me. We've got the bill currently being carried by Representative Steer on the duty to intercede training that, as you know, when you were vice chair, that I've carried for several years trying to get this exact kind of training. And I believe you were in the meeting with then Chair Mariani when we talked about having this put in, this type of training put into that bill. I would think if you looked at that language on that bill, that we could just do a little bit of things and make that fit your desire, get that language in that you want, and that we could move forward. And I think that's a very doable thing. So we could always do better. I hope that we as a committee will work together and we'll take this and move forward. Thank you, ma'am.
Closing remarks, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Co-Chair Novotny. Thank you for what you just added. I'll just say this: I think that it's okay to admit when we have problems. That's okay, and part of our jobs as legislators is to solve those problems, or to find ways to at least try to solve those problems. And so I feel like oftentimes when we have these conversations, it's kind of a zero-sum game, or someone or something has to be demonized if we're acknowledging that there's an actual real issue out there that we should try to address. And there are issues with our traffic stops. There are disparities. We know that. And I didn't even spend a lot of time focusing on disparities or those issues. I cited one study that talked about disparities, but there are issues. But that's okay. We're all humans. We're going to make mistakes. But if we know that we have issues, we can try to find ways to resolve those issues, and we can put resources towards those. This isn't a one-size-fits-all. I'm inviting everybody to the conversation. I was just telling Chief Potts, I feel like you can't win. I'm damned if I don't invite people. I'm damned if I do invite people. But I'm inviting everybody to the conversation because I think it's important that law enforcement has a voice in this, because this is about your profession. You do walk those shoes. You drive in those squad cars. But I'll end again on what I said last time. The community and civilians, they walk their shoes every day, and they remember these interactions, and they have input on how they like to see them be better, to build trust and accountability in the community. And I think we should always keep that as front of mind, because we are the servants. We are the service of the community. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier, and thank you for bringing this bill. I think, we've talked about this in past years as well with Philando's death, and the fact that and his mom's in the room, and I think he was 32 when he died, and he had been stopped, I believe, over 40 times in his young life and his young time as a driver. And so it's just, I think, to what everybody said here, and Hollins and Representative Hollins, Representative Frazier, I mean, that clearly does indicate a problem. We've been trying for years to come up with different solutions. I think this is one solution. We talked about limiting stops in certain kinds of cases to kind of eliminate those low-level non-traffic safety stops, and that was rejected, and there was some thought that that would be confusing to implement. Representative Frazier and I have been working to try to really get rid of some of those low-level stops through a rewrite of Chapter 168 and 169. I think we're still waiting from that bill from the reviser. So this isn't the end of the conversation, and just really appreciate everybody's willingness to engage in this today. And with that, I renew the motion and lay over House File 686 for possible inclusion in a public safety budget bill. Members, that concludes today's agenda. We are adjourned.